has come and found us here with our toys scattered all around us here.
13 minutes after 4 o'clock on Downtown. Our next guest, Jimmy Webb, has written us so many hit songs for folks. That's one that was a big hit for Glenn Campbell. And that's a version he did with Keith Urban on his album Still Within the Sound of My Voice of Where's the Playground, Susie? Jimmy will be here in concert Wednesday, November 14th, 3 weeks from today at the Brewer Performing Arts Center. Tickets are available online at brewerperformingarts.com. We had a chance to catch up with Jimmy just a few days back and talked with him about the upcoming concert and whether or not it would be his first time playing and performing in the Bangor area.
Yeah, it will be. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, it's a great...
I want to have a look around because I love Maine, but... It'll be a different crowd for me, and so it's always fun to go into a venue for the first time.
Well, it's a nice performance space. I think you'll like it in there. We'll do our best to keep the snow from falling before you get here.
maybe you have some spells and incantations or...
Well, you know, Stephen King owns our radio station, so we
naked by the moonlight, or
whatever it takes, we'll make it happen. Here. Let's. Can we talk a little bit? You're doing a lot of touring these days. So many of these songs you wrote when you were a pretty young guy. Do you change your approach to any of the songs? Do they have a different meaning for you now than they did when you first wrote them?
Well. I think there's a challenge, and it's a very good question. But, I mean, these songs, a lot of them are 50 years old. I mean, let's just, say what it is. You know, it's not 20, it's not 30, it's not, we're talking 50 years, half a century. And I've been very fortunate to live, to see these songs survive. A lot of them are still of interest. We still get recordings on MacArthur Park in Wichita Lineman every year. So to keep interested in them, I think, is one of the challenges of performing live. But I never, and I'll tell the audience, and you'll hear me say this if you're here at the concert. I say, I never do the same thing twice. So you can always come back and see me, and it'll be a completely different concert.
Well, that's the beauty of live performance.
That's the truth, and it's my, so burden of proof that I carry on the stage with me every night as a performer, that I can get back into the material, I can bring it to life again, and I can make them feel what I was feeling when I wrote it. That's my challenge as a performer. And sometimes I do newer. I still write all the time. I'm going to do a. I've got songs for a solo album for next year. I'm doing a piano album. And I do a lot of writing. I just did a memoir last year, The Cake in the Rain. And so I'm busy. I don't live in the past. I don't like to think of myself as living in the past. But people want to hear these songs. So when Glenn Campbell passed away, I vowed that as long as I could play and saying that nobody would forget him or his songs. And so that's part of my mission. And I talk about Glenn quite a bit. He was really an extraordinary character. I mean, one in 100 million musicians and singers.
Well, you talk about Glenn, and I know you recently did a show with his daughter, Ashley. What was that experience like?
Well, I'm having a blast with Ashley. She's a formidable virtuoso on banjo. That's her forte. And I can remember her father. I can remember the two of them in front of the fireplace up in Malibu years ago. And I think she was about 11. And he was playing either Highwayman or Sunshower, one of those things that had one of those really kind of complex things that I do once in a while. And she was just watching his fingers like, here's an 11-year-old holding a guitar and just doing what Daddy did, you know? And there's something about that vignette that really stays in my memory. And she's grown up to be really formidable. And she's very, very easy to look at. And she's a very positive influence. And she keeps me young, and she keeps the show young. So we've been having some pretty good gigs together. And we have more booked out this year. So, you know, as long as she wants to do it, I'll do it.
But you told us in the past when you've been on the show, nobody recorded more of your songs than Glenn Campbell. Is there one song in your mind that's the peak of that artistic collaboration between you two?
Well, the one that I think has had the most, that has provoked the most reaction and probably more covers than any other, is Wichita Lineman. And it was, you know, almost a throwaway song. I sent it to him in an unfinished state and told him it wasn't finished. I hadn't written the last verse. He didn't think it needed a last verse, but I didn't know that for a couple of weeks. And I said, you know, I ran into him at a session. I said, I guess you guys didn't like Wichita Lineman. Wichita Lineman? He says, we cut that. But Glenn, I said, it wasn't finished. I put a note in the package. I said, this song is not finished, you know, JLW. He said, it is now. So that's the way Glenn was, and he always exercised his prerogative as producer and arranger and veteran of thousands of recording sessions and hundreds of sessions that produced hit records.
Well, yeah, and you tell the story in the book, too, that you felt like they were still missing something, and you had an old organ and captured that incredible sound at the end. And I think you mentioned in the book that Glenn called somebody up and said, you need to come get this big old organ and get it down to, I think it was Western Recorders, right?
Well, he got really excited about it, and it was a church organ. And we didn't have synthesizers in those days, but we had fancy church organs, because, mind you, my job before I moved to Hollywood was I was church organist for my father, who was a Baptist minister. And so I would get on the organ committee, and I would buy the organs that were all tricked out with rhythm generators, and so I could play rock and roll on them. And they also had a lot of, even though we didn't have synthesizers properly, they had electronic sounds on them. They had you would call a tremolo or a repetition of a sound and a sustain. There was a sound on the organ that I had just brought up and said, you want to hear something crazy? You know, and this was a great sound. It sort of sounded like a satellite or something like that. And he got excited, and he said, let's put that on the record, you know. And I didn't have to do anything except hold down two notes, just hold them down. The organ sort of went through this satellite routine where it arpeggiated and automatically played this thing up and down, and it was just kind of a shivery sound, but all I was playing was two notes. And I said, you know that organ? I said, it weighs about 2,000 pounds, you know? I said, we had a hell of a time getting it up those stairs. He said, he picked up the phone and said, Shorty? He said, he was talking to SIR, and he said, can you guys get over here with the truck, you know. And that's the way Glenn was. So the organ went down to the studio, and later that night I was just sitting there playing those two notes, and they recorded a bit of it. And you can hear it to this day. You can hear it on the fade. You know, it sounds like some sort of communications apparatus. Something. It was just.
We're talking to Jimmy Webb.
Touch of sound that I think really contributed to the record.
Oh, there's no question. Jimmy Webb with us here on Downtown. I want to talk about another artist that collaborated with you several times, most notably on her album Cry Like a Rainstorm, Howl Like the Wind, one of the great vocalists in pop music. Can you talk a little bit about Linda Ronstadt?
Well, Linda's almost my sister. She and I were born very close to the same day. I'm not going to get into too much detail about that. But We went on a wonderful musical journey together. I think that I had four songs on Cry Like a Rainstorm. It was a platinum album back when we had platinum albums. And you know, she produced my album Suspending Disbelief. Which really, in my view, should have had more success than it did. But she is a bright lady. She's a bright, strong woman, and she's really one of my heroines at this moment because of the way she's dealing with Parkinson's disease. And it's very ironic for me because I'm starting to feel the impact of these diseases. Alzheimer's took Glenn, and I'm just pleased that Linda has, you know, persevered against this Parkinson's and is still very, very active and has a lecture circuit. She no longer performs, but. And I think that's for me, that's a very sad thing, because she was one of the people who believed in me and would go out and put her money where her mouth was. You know, she cut my songs. She spoke highly of me in her memoir. She's aces in my book.
You also worked a lot through the years with Art Garfunkel. You wrote his first solo hit, All I Know, many of the songs on the Watermark album. And I was a young radio guy at the time, still shocked to this day, 40-some years later, that Crying in My Sleep didn't become a big hit.
Yeah, I mean, there were some things like that don't make sense. And I think that you just have to, you know, at the very, very outset, you know, if you're going to enjoy the unlikely record that becomes a hit and go, oh, my God, you know, how fantastic. Up, Up, and Away was one of those kind of lost children that was just almost accidentally released. It was like, I think, the third or fourth single off that record. And so, you know, it made a good showing and actually earned me a Grammy for Song of the Year. And so and that was all completely accidental. And if you're going to take any pleasure in that, then you have to accept the fact that sometimes the best laid plans just don't come off the way you want them to. I would have thought that was a hit, and I still think it's a hit.
Mm.
And I get a lot of requests for it, but you know it's almost a mystical thing, a hit record. The day it's released, the season of the year, whether it's a summer record or a winter record, or
right,
what's the mood of the country? What was the mood of the band that day when they came in to cut the record? Was there something wrong with it that you didn't hear? Was it just not promoted correctly? it just didn't get the push from the label. Who knows? I mean, we're talking about so many variables, I mean, including the temperature in the studio. I think it's very difficult to figure out what makes a hit record.
Jimmy, the last time you were on with us was around the time of the release of your book, which is so wonderful, The Cake and the Rain. I went back and reread it again this weekend. And
wow, you're a glutton for punishment.
No, I love the book so much. So many great stories and memories. I wonder if you could share one of my favorite stories from the book about when Frank Sinatra rolled out the red carpet for you and especially for your dad.
Well, that was really nice. You know, he was all, Mr. Sinatra was always very, very nice to me. He loved songwriters, and he would sit and listen to songwriters for hours. We used to get together once every year or two, you know, for most of the remainder of his life. When I met him when he was, I think, probably about 50. One time I went up to Vegas to see him. He always, you know, he always treated me like royalty. But he said, "Why don't you bring your father?" You know, and I thought, well, yeah, that's a nice thing, you know, because my dad, you know, would just be bowled over. And then when I told him, he couldn't believe it. I said, "Yeah, we're Mr. Sinatra's guests." We went up to Caesar's Palace, and of course, everything was paid for, and there were markers and special tickets, special seats at the show. And after the show, Mr. Sinatra had us backstage, and then he said, why don't you guys come to dinner with me tomorrow night at the Jockey Club before the show? And I said, great. So my father and I went off to the Jockey Club with this, you know, unbelievably famous guy who had sort of been the standard bearer and literally the standards of World War II, all those great songs. That my father was in the South Pacific. And so they got their heads together, and they, as we ate dinner and had a couple of drinks, and the conversation actually strayed so far from anything that I knew about. They were talking about bands that I'd never heard of, and they were talking about the battles and different ships and different people and different tours and times that my father had seen the show and this and that and the other thing. And after a while, I said, listen, you guys are having such a great time. I'm just going to go upstairs. They ended up spending pretty much the whole evening together. I think they went to the craps table, and my father like crapped out. He lost everything he had on him, and I always say, but after that night, my father had a spring in his step. He was a made man.
We're talking with Jimmy Webb. The music world has changed so much, and we've talked about this with a number of artists. Your friend Van Dyke Parks has explained to us how little songwriters get through streaming audio services. You've had your battles with the Recording Industry Association of America over songwriter credit when the sampling is done. Are we getting any closer to making a more equitable situation for songwriters in this digital age?
Well, you know, that my battle with Naris is not over. They may think it is, but it's not over. Until they put me down, I will be out there rabble rousing and asking the question, why do highly regarded legendary songwriters, why do they not get credit when their songs are sampled and then nominated for Grammy Awards? And my case is pretty strong. I mean, I almost have a legal case I could bring. I may do that. I think that, you know, we just got some action from Congress that's been long overdue. And so very hard to achieve. I mean, it is, I've been on the ASCAP board for, it will be almost 20 years next year. And I think when I serve out my term this year, I think I'll be, I think I'll make it to 20, but I may have to run again. But almost two decades. And this is the first time we ever got anything like a bill through Congress that attempts to redress some of the inequities that have been just diabolically enforced by this digital industry and these big monopolies like Google and Amazon and radio stations like Spotify and Pandora. And we just have to change the culture, that's all. We've lost a little bit of our sensitivity towards the cultural side of things in America in the last couple of decades, where we have forgotten that there was a time when songwriters were really honored and respected. Oscar Hammerstein, Richard Rodgers, Larry Hart, Yip Harburg, Harold Arlen. We've forgotten that so much of our culture is actually created by these oft-times humble men who really work in the back room and don't look for a lot of attention and don't, you know, they're not Kanye West types. They're not in the Oval Office, you know, talking to the president about something, you know, blimp or something. But they're just guys who go to work and enrich all of our lives. I mean, music, we get married to it. We get buried to it. We have dinner to it. We make love to it. We go for a walk to it. We can't drive our car without it. What would we listen to when they put us on hold on a telephone? We didn't have music. Music is really important, and the people who make music are important to people. And I'm going to see to it, as long as I can breathe, that that's remembered.
Well, we wish you well in that fight. When it comes to music, we around here cannot wait till you're here at the Brewer Performing Arts Center singing so many of your songs in Evening with Jimmy Webb coming up on Wednesday, November 14th. And we've talked about it before. You've got a place in Maine. A lot of the book was written here in Maine. So this is, even though you haven't been in this part of the state before, we look at it as a homecoming for you.
Well, you know what? It is a homecoming. And I'm going to be coming up there with my buddy Danny Ferguson, who's my road guy, roadmaster, and he's a citizen of Maine. He's lived there since 1971. I think he bought his house. And no, we're coming in like Mainers. I know that I will never be a Mainer, but I'm a part-time Mainer, and I love that state. I love the people. I'm looking forward to it.
That's the great Jimmy Webb. He'll be joining us in Evening with Jimmy Webb, the Brewer Performing Arts Center, Wednesday, November 14th. Tickets available right now, brewerperformingarts.com. It's going to be a special evening, and we're so excited to be bringing him here to the area.